Summer is usually a great time for food choices for people in Wisconsin. Backyard gardens, farmers markets, grocery stores brimming with fresh produce. But for a lot of people, they don't have those choices because school is not in session. A lot of kids get their nutrition during the school year, so we need your help. St. Vincent de Paul has a food pantry that gives your neighbor in need some of the same choices you have. But to keep it going, we need your help, your donations, support the food pantry. And you can do one of a couple things. Drop off an extra bag of groceries from the store or your local farmer's market. Also, a $50 cash donation feeds a family of five for a week. You can organize a food drive, whatever it takes to keep that food pantry going this summer while the kids are at home. Let's do what we can. Here's what you do. You contact St. Vincent de Paul at svdpmadison.org. That's svdpmadison.org. Let's work on this together. Welcome to another podcast at slysoffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers and great local sponsors like Madison Computer Works, S&I Remodeling, the Axley Law Firm, and of course, our friends at St. Vincent de Paul. Joining us now, Associate Editor of the Capital Times and Correspondent for The Nation, John Nichols. John, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Sly. I am happy today.
Are you happy today?
A good day.
Well, there interesting takes on the Comey testimony. Before I start playing some clips, why don't you give me your overall sense of what transpired today, other than that John McCain maybe needs to take a nap?
You know what his excuse was? For people who saw it, we'll explain it in a moment, but his excuse was he stayed up too late watching the Diamondbacks.
Oh.
He used that excuse.
Oh, okay.
And so the nap thing is real.
Yeah.
McCain asked a question that will go into the vault where we keep the great, kind of moments in public events, right next to the close of the 1984 debate where Reagan kind of trailed off talking about the Pacific Coast Highway.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was really good. So the Comey hearing was, better than I expected. Comey obviously released his testimony yesterday because he is a master showman. He's like Thomas Jefferson and other, historic American, folks who portray themselves as, like dedicated civil servants, but are actually really good at making sure they control the news cycles. So he released his testimony yesterday to make sure he gets a whole night of that. And then he goes and testifies, gets another day of it. So it's a very smart way to drive his point home. And his point, even though he was cautious in stating it, is that Donald Trump is guilty of obstruction of justice. And that if you listen to the testimony, rather than to the spin about the testimony, that's the heart and soul of it. Asked by Dianne Feinstein why he was fired, he had, obviously a very well thought answer, which is, I have to believe what the president said. I was fired because of Russia.
Here is kind of the opening shot from James Comey.
The administration then chose to defame me and, more importantly, the FBI, by saying that the organization was in disarray, that it was poorly led, that the workforce had lost confidence in its leader. Those were lies, plain and simple.
You know, for people, there are some people today on social media saying they thought this was boring. I did not watch every minute of it. I listened to a lot of it on the radio. I did not find it boring at all.
I have to agree with you. As you know, between us personally, today I'm obsessed with the British election, and so I had other things that were driving me, but I, social responsibility, all sorts of other things, journalistic duties, I tuned in the hearing, and I thought I was going to do a little hearing, little other stuff. It was just fabulous. Comey's testimony was, as you say, riveting. It was really, really well done, and you can't, it's one of those things that you can't actually get on radio. Usually radio is a perfect vehicle to get all.
You know, I listened to much of the Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill hearings on the radio, driving around Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Putting up barn signs for Russ Feingold in the fall of 1991. We were already putting up barn signs.
Useful work. Useful work. But radio is usually really good. But in this case, it wasn't, because you had to see Comey. He had memorized his testimony, which is, of course, a very subtle message. Because, of course, it says the guy can remember a lot of stuff, if you get my drift. And so he was looking straight into the camera, talking very comfortably. Like that last clip you played was him looking, you know, essentially looking at the camera. And so it was very powerful, very strong. And then the question and answer was incredibly effective, because Comey gave short, almost clipped answers. He didn't go on. He didn't, you know, there wasn't sort of a struggling with things. Most of his answers were one sentence. They were one, maybe two sentences, and often a yes and a no. Now, because of a couple of other factors, the most riveting questioning of him was often from people who have background as prosecutors, who have background in the law. And so people like Kamala Harris, her questions were very clipped and very tight. So the whole thing was fast-moving. It was really interesting. There was, you know, the attempts, the kind of pathetic, sub, you know, competent, just tragic, phone-it-in attempts by, you know, folks like Tom Cotton, who really is, you know, kind of looking more and more like a, you know, a tragic figure in American politics. And, you know, Blunt from Missouri.
He's supposed to be a Rhodes Scholar.
Yeah, boy, he wasn't paying attention. Just terribly inept.
Well, if you really want to hear ineptitude, how about this guy? This guy from Idaho that was born in Wisconsin. What's his name? Is it pronounced Reich?
Rich?
Rich or Reich?
Yeah. Rich or Reich? Yeah. Yeah, nobody's ever heard of him.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he's not. Let's put it this way. I'd kind of put him in the spectrum of senators right there in history with Malcolm Wallop, if you know what I mean. Okay, so here's remember him? Here is.
Well, that was good. That was good. The North Dakota used to send, or South Dakota. Remember Roman? Was it Ruska? That was a good one, too. There was a guy who, I think he argued once that somebody said what he was saying was completely, you know, irrational or, like, stupid. And he said, well, irrational, stupid people have a right to representation.
There you go. Although no one may top Jesse Kramer this week. All right, the senator, the senior senator from Idaho.
I gather from all this that you're willing to say now that while you were director, the president of the United States was not under investigation. Is that a fair statement?
That's correct. The challenge, and I'm not picking on reporters, about writing stories about classified information is the people talking about it often don't really know what's going on, and those of us who actually know what's going on are not talking about it, and we don't call the press to say, hey, you got that thing wrong about this sensitive topic. We just have to leave it there.
I hope you can let this go. Now, those are his exact words. Is that correct?
Correct.
He did not direct you to let it go.
Not in his words, no.
He did not order you to let it go.
Again, those words are not an order. The reason I keep saying his words is I took it as a direction.
Right.
I mean, this is the President of the United States with me alone saying, I hope this. I took it as this is what he wants me to do.
Why did...
That was... a critical exchange, actually.
Right.
Yeah.
First of all, this notion that, you know, technically Trump isn't under investigation at the time of Comey's departure means absolutely nothing.
Of course, it's irrelevant. And it's also irrelevant to this discussion, because this discussion is not about, you know, 90% of the topics that come up. This discussion is about whether the president engaged in obstruction of justice. Did he pressure the FBI to back off an investigation into an associate who, Flynn, who knows a lot about Trump and who might have some things to say about Trump? Thus, obstruction of justice not merely to protect a friend, but potentially to protect himself. Did he engage in that? That fly is in the first article of impeachment against Richard Nixon, one of the top items that is listed, pressuring the FBI to back off an investigation. I mean, this is not, you understand, what we're talking about here is not you know, some gray area or some uncertain thing. If the president pressured the FBI, if he used his position, even prior to the firing of Comey, Comey being obviously, you know, just an extension of that, but a very serious one. But if he pressured the FBI to back off an investigation to protect an associate or himself, he engaged in precisely the act that Republicans and Democrats on the Judiciary Committee in 1974 said you could and should impeach Richard Nixon.
Well, and that is why the humiliating performance from Dan Coats and Mike Rogers yesterday is so important.
Oh, yeah, because they did not choose to be John Dean.
They did not.
They didn't choose to acknowledge the cancer.
At least not publicly.
But it doesn't matter. You know, I mean, look, they're clearly playing games here. And, you know, we're at a very interesting point. I don't think we're at an impeachment point. That's not what I'm saying. I am at the point where the people who are listening to this will, in their reasoned approach, conclude that their president is, to use the Nixonian term, a crook.
You know, everybody's got to be a little patient. I see people, especially on social media, you know, going off, making a determination. Well, it's not going to happen. He's never going to be convinced. You know, honestly, can people just be a little patient and see this thing through?
This is a progression. And again, I keep trying to tell people, you know, they're too obsessed with Mueller, too little obsessed with the congressional process. The congressional process is more important and more likely to produce a result that matters, not a result that they might like or dislike, but one that matters. And so what happened in this hearing today was a very, very big deal, because you really did lay out a lot of the grounds for obstruction. You had the ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff, saying that, you know, everything that was said pointed to obstruction of justice. And, you know, so we're getting into that zone. And again, people will become obsessed with the legalistic stuff. Don't. Focus in on the fact that Nixon was never convicted of obstruction of justice before or after. Obviously, he was pardoned, but before or after he left the presidency. But it was the conclusion of Congress that the weight of the evidence was sufficient to impeach him, i.e. to put him on trial for a host of wrongs, including obstruction of justice.
Here is...
I know people are not going to... Let me just finish this one thought. I know people are not going to believe that Republicans would do that, and it's just, oh, it's no way. I'll tell you, if you watch Burr's performance today, what you saw is there are Republicans who are open to seeing this thing through.
Well, clearly...
Maybe
his,
not impeachment,
his praise of Comey at the end of the hearing was palpable.
And also, if you looked at Susan Collins just this afternoon in her interviews, I mean, she was just, you know, you couldn't distinguish her reaction to the hearing from those of many of the Democrats.
Here is Dianne Feinstein.
Why do you believe you were fired?
I take the president at his word that I was fired because of the Russia investigation. Something about the way I was conducting it, the president felt, created pressure on him that he wanted to relieve. Our absolute primary concern was we can't infect the investigative team. We don't want the agents and analysts working on this to know the president of the United States has asked, and when it comes from the president, I took it as a direction to get rid of this investigation.
So,
keywords there.
Keywords.
He took it as a direction.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so clearly was a direction.
No, but I mean, he said it. That's important. And this was a nuanced, thoughtful testimony. You note that unlike people who testify usually, this is a guy who's actually investigated a lot of stuff, questioned a lot of people. He didn't jump to make his points. He let himself be asked 2 and 3 times before he slowly, carefully laid out why it wasn't an ask. And so it's very effective in that regard. Much more effective. It'll look more effective, actually, in hindsight than even to some people that watched it today.
Some people are questioning why he didn't tell the president what he was doing, that he met numerous times with the president. What he was doing was wrong. What do you make of that?
He has a 10-year appointment. His job is to be insulated from politics. If he was an appointee of the president, okay, if he was a member of the cabinet, if he was a member of the president's inner circle, and he saw the president engaging in that behavior, if he was Reince Priebus, for instance, he has a moral and political, potentially legal duty to report the act and to resign. Okay? We know that. That's a given. But the head of the FBI is not a part of the president's administration. He is, in fact, the person who investigates, among other things, the president's administration, if the investigation leads there. And so the notion that he should report it to somebody else or step down is absurd. No.
Here he is.
As he said, his job is to insulate the investigation. And in fact, if Trump is talking that way, his job is to do what he did. He went to Jeff Sessions and he said, I need to be separated from this president and the pressure he's trying to put on me. But obviously, as Comey indicated, he wanted to continue the investigation.
Here is one more clip, and then we're going to move on to other topics. So if you give a short answer on this, here is James Comey.
Did the president, in any of those interactions that you've shared with us today, ask you what you should be doing or what our government should be doing or the intelligence community to protect America against Russian interference in our election system?
I don't recall a conversation like that.
Never.
No.
Do you find it odd?
Not with President Trump.
Right.
Attended a fair number of meetings on that with President Obama.
Ooh, in goes the knife.
You just summed it up. I mean, everybody else was interested in the issue. Trump not only wasn't interested, I mean, you know, look, every element of this testimony, both what was said directly and what was indicated, suggests that Trump's mission, his purpose, was to shut down inquiry into these issues, not to advance it. Now, we don't know why that is. Well, you know, that's, as people were saying today, what we got from today clearly says that at some point, Donald Trump should be put under oath and brought before a congressional committee. I mean, that's what we've gotten to. Now, that's unlikely to happen for a whole bunch of reasons, both historic and structural. But the fact of the matter is, that's the legitimate counter to what Comey said today, would be to put Trump under oath, see what he says, and then start to sort this thing out.
I love the story that came out this week about Trump's legal team unable to find a legitimate, seasoned Washington law firm to represent him in this situation because, A, they don't think...
Is the Joker they brought in?
Oh, yeah. No, I've got a clip of him, too.
But, God.
A, they don't think he'll pay. B, they don't think he'll take advice. And B, and this is my favorite, this is according to the Washington Post, they're worried about the reputation of their law firm.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, look, here's the bottom line on this thing. The guy who is representing Trump and who got up and did this, you know, really one of the most absurd, you know, they're referring to it as Trump's attorney is an alt lawyer. You know,
let's just take a break. Let's just take a break here, and then we'll pick it up from there. John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation at SlysOffice.com.
Injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh.
John and I approach personal injury cases in the same way. We want to be certain that our clients are treated fairly, that our clients are comfortable, that our clients know they can trust us to get the best result for them.
It's our professional responsibility to make certain you are fairly and fully compensated. Most of our cases are settled without a trial.
Call injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh at 257-5661 for the personal attention you deserve.
And we're back at SlysOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steel Workers. All right, so Nichols, since we're going to move on, but since we preface this is Mark Kasowitz, who is Donald Trump's attorney.
It is now established that the president was not being investigated for colluding with or attempting to obstruct any investigation. As the committee pointed out today, these important facts for the country to know are virtually the only facts that have not been leaked during the course of these events. As he said yesterday, the president feels completely vindicated and is eager to continue moving forward with his agenda, with the business of this country, and with this public cloud removed.
You know, I think Sean Hannity would have said that, not even required a retainer.
Well, or a White House spokesperson. You understand, there was nothing legal or legalistic about that. That was a press secretary statement. It was a written, prepared statement designed to deliver a couple of talking points, not, you know, and it was, I hope Trump isn't paying a lot for that representation, because it did him more harm than more good. What it did was, obviously, it put out a talking point for his base, you know, that somehow Comey's a leaker. But it gave everybody in the, you know, like, rational, you know, kind of functioning cortex community, a chance to say, of course, that Comey, what he's accusing Comey of doing, Comey did as a private citizen. It's not a leak as when you do that as a private citizen. So, I mean, and also apparently he got things wrong, that his timeline, the lawyer's timeline was wrong, you know, things that he referenced, if what I was hearing on NBC today was right. So the end result is it was a totally ridiculous performance. And in fact, in fairness to Donald Trump, if you had done a purely legalistic appearance and you'd said, you know, look, this guy said specifically, Trump's not under, it wasn't under investigation, you know, asked specifically, did Trump tell him to, you know, pull back on the investigation? Comey said no. You know what I mean? And if you just sort of cut out all the nuance of Comey's testimony, the stuff that actually gave it substance, you could have made a statement that sort of portrayed Trump as innocent, even though he's guilty. The fascinating thing was that lawyer didn't even do that. It was very ham-handed, and it will be immediately forgotten, except maybe by Sean Hannity.
Let me ask you about what's going on in Great Britain. And, of course, you know, by the time this podcast gets out, understand that we will probably have a greater definition on what exactly right. happened. But give me your overall impression of what's happening on Election Day in Great Britain.
It's a huge deal. I mean, you know what the interesting thing is? That everybody in America is very obsessed with the Comey hearing testimony, and appropriately so. But in the rest of the world, including even U.S. financial media, was all focused on Britain, because Theresa May, the Prime Minister of Britain, called a snap election. They do that in Britain. They can have a very quick election, basically a six-week campaign, because she wanted to dramatically increase her conservative majority. She's a member of Thatcher's Conservative Party, so that she'd have a strong position to negotiate Brexit, which is the British exit from European community. And I only give that background to say that's why the rest of the world's fascinated, because this is all about really the future of the global economy, interrelation of countries, et cetera. And the assumption was that May was going to win overwhelmingly because she was running against a genuine leftist, a passionate socialist named Jeremy Corbyn. And Corbyn was ridiculed by the media, horribly attacked by the elites, even attacked by the centrists, the Blairites in his own party. And yet, when all was said and done, it looks like Corbyn significantly, I would argue, you know, massively increased the Labour total by something like 34, 35 seats. May's party, the Conservatives, have fallen well short of a majority. If the exit polls are right, and we're only talking about exit polls now, so we have to be careful. And that means that May is going to have to struggle to put a government together when this thing started by her with double-digit leads in the polls and talking about literally, you know, kind of wiping out the other party and having this strong position. What this means, I would suggest to you, Sly, is no matter what the final result we see, it's another incredibly clear signal that the elites in media and in politics do not understand the power of popular frustration and anger with austerity, with economies that are organized for the very rich. And that, to Corbyn brilliantly spoke about that, as well as Bernie Sanders did in the U.S., and had an almost unimaginably powerful increase in vote for his party. Again, he didn't win, and that's not the point here. I mean, obviously winning is the point, you'd love to, but that's not the point of what I'm saying.
What I am saying is...
that there's some powerful messages that came out.
Is this election London versus other parts of the country? What happened in Scotland and Northern Ireland?
Now, it's different than that. Parts of London, are actually very left and voted, for Labour. So that wasn't quite what it was. What happened, which was fascinating, is that Corbyn, running far to the left, won back a lot of Scotland. Scotland has been voting in the last few cycles for the Scottish National Party. And apparently Labour won a lot of seats in Scotland. We'll see what the final playout is. Again, we're talking off exit polls before they've, come out with all the final results. And then also did very, very well in the traditional Labour heartlands in the north. And so what's fascinating...
Are those the places where they threw parties when Margaret Thatcher died?
They didn't celebrate her tenure, let's just say that.
Yeah.
The mining communities that she absolutely brutalized. And there is a popular T-shirt in England, especially in the north of England, that says, still hate Thatcher. And Theresa May had the unfortunate reality of claiming to be sort of a Thatcher-like figure. But if you can imagine, all the meanness and disengagement and, sort of uncaring approach to the great mass of humanity that was, Thatcher's watchword, combined with being kind of boring and unpleasant.
Well, she reminds me very much of a middle school English teacher I had named Miss Duffy, who always wore her sweater over her shoulders and was a brutal woman. I'm sure she's long since passed. All right,
the thing that's interesting is I think that your reaction was mirrored by an awfully lot of voters in England. They may have had a different teacher in a different grade, but yes, I think they may have seen some of that.
All right, real quick. Paul Soglin is considering running for governor. Scott Walker immediately threw a series of labels at him, calling him a 60s throwback and a radical. I pointed out on Facebook that Scott Walker is an 1860s radical throwback.
He would have been on the side of the Republican Party in the 60s is the question.
Right. Interestingly enough, Tony Evers is now putting out fundraising requests. He got reelected. I don't really think he was short on money. Maybe he's just paying bills from the campaign. But that is very interesting. I got that email blast yesterday. Dana Walks, obviously, I think is virtually certain to run. How do you see this race shaping up?
Well, it seems like people are showing interest in it. And, our Republican friends, who we love so much,
especially Jesse Kramer.
Oh, well, he hasn't been around as long as some of the other folks. Did you get that? That was a spell.
I did.
All right. Although, did you notice that Walker didn't reject the, he didn't like come down strong for evolution?
No, he sure didn't.
But here's the bottom line on the governor's race. Our Republican friends have been just desperate to say that the Democrats are in disarray and they don't have a candidate and it's, just... The Democratic Party is somehow completely gone and dysfunctional. Now, you and I are both very critical of the Democratic Party. But I'll note that just as the Republican Party hasn't, settled on a candidate against Tammy Baldwin, Democrats haven't settled on a candidate against Scott Walker. What is happening, however, is as, we sort of move into the time when people should be thinking about running, you're getting some credible people step up. The mayor of Madison is a credible candidate. The superintendent of public instruction, just reelected with 70% of the vote, is a credible candidate. A state rep from outstate Wisconsin certainly fits the model of a credible candidate. And some of the other people whose names are being thrown out. Here's the bottom line.
No, the only person that's not a credible candidate is Mike McCabe.
Well, he can run too. Everybody's
well, he can run.
Everybody.
He can run. He's just not a credible candidate.
Well, I think
you have to have more than 191 likes on Facebook.
I bet you could get more if you try. And bottom line is that the focus is shifting to.
By the way, my nickname for him is?
Oh no!
There was Mr. Green Jeans. I call him Mr. Blue Jeans.
Blue Jean Nation.
Blue Jean Nation, yeah. Mr. Blue Jeans.
Well, he's making an effort. You know, I mean, I see no reason.
I don't see him putting as much effort in this as when he was the voice for Cheryl Wilhoit when she begged principals to spy on teachers for union activity. He was quite vociferous in his support for the superintendent then. That wasn't very. Was that fair of me to bring that up?
I think you are on your high horse, Mister. Get down off your high horse. Talk politics with me for a second. hey, here's what I'll tell you. This is the thing. You know, the thing to keep in mind. What we've seen with Bernie Sanders' campaign, what we're seeing from Britain with Jeremy Corbyn, if he did indeed, you know, massively increase the labor position in the parliament and potentially hold a sitting prime minister below a majority with everything going against him, is that some fascinating things are happening in our politics. And candidates who will actually say things and be blunt and not play the game have tremendously more potential than they did in the past. There is no more cookie-cutter, traditional, you know, stamped out of the, you know, mold politician than Scott Walker. He is the embodiment of, you know, kind of old school traditional career politician. And in fact, he's identified as such, if you want to make ads, by Donald Trump, right? Trump, you know, shredded Scott Walker. And so you have him and you can pick a candidate against him. All I would argue is the candidate against Scott Walker must be incredibly blunt, incredibly strong, ready to, you know, take swings at him to really, you know, go hard on the economic and social issues and the corruption issues. And I know there's people who say, oh, a candidate from Madison, like, you know, Paul Sagan, he can't do that. Wrong. Actually, a candidate from Madison might be perfectly positioned to do that. It's certainly a candidate like Sagan. Like Tony Evers can't do it.
He wasn't necessarily an economic populist. But in 1982, Tony Earle ran a very liberal campaign with Democratic Party was starting to switch into identity politics. But he ran ran for the nuclear freeze, and it was a bad year for Republicans, and Tony Earle got in.
And you know what? You know why it was a bad year? 2 years earlier, Republicans had elected a president who promised everybody everything.
Uh-huh.
Didn't deliver, and frankly, had divided the nation at a lot of lines. And so, you know, the patterns sometimes hold. And all I'm saying about this is, look, if I was choosing the candidate against Scott Walker, I've said it before, I think with you, I would put Chris Taylor up. I think Chris Taylor from the state rep from Madison would be an outstanding candidate and would just excite people and, you know, would just do great. If she chooses not to run, I think there now are a number of people showing interest in potential candidates who could do just great. The only thing I'll tell you is one bottom line. The candidate against Scott Walker cannot be a traditional consultant-designed candidate. That's the only way that Scott Walker wins.
John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation. Thanks for coming to SlysOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers.
SlysOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.
You know, we work hard every day. In mills and mines, hospitals and schools, in office buildings, pharmacies and shipyards, factories and forests, in squad cars, ambulances and taxicabs. We do all kinds of jobs in Iowa, Wisconsin, Illinois, and all across the United States and Canada. We build the things that build our country. We do things that keep our country going, support our families and our communities. We have the courage to stand up even when no one else does. We have the strength to fight for what's right, for our families and for yours. We're your friends, your neighbors, your sisters and brothers. We're more than 1 million members strong. We stand in solidarity with workers in every continent on the globe. We're the United Steelworkers Union, and every day we fight for you. Please join our fight. Visit usw.org or like us at facebook.com/steelworkers.